Michigan lawmakers consider legislation that would crack down on aggressive panhandling. Critics say there's a free speech issue because the bill singles out poor people. I'm Cynthia Canty. Later on, we'll find out what panhandlers think. But first, the U.S. Justice Department, Attorney General Bill Schuette, and Genesee County Prosecutor David Layton have asked Governor Snyder's administration to shut down its internal investigations into the Flint water crisis. They all say those administrative civil inquiries may have damaged their criminal investigations. Governor Snyder's office has called off its internal probe and asked the legislature's Auditor General to do the same. With us now is Wayne State University law professor Peter Henning. Peter, we're talking about administrative probes into the Department of Environmental Quality and the Department of Health and Human Services. And I want to start with you by quoting from the Attorney General's letter. Quote, "These two investigations have compromised the ongoing criminal investigation and may cause the guilty to go free, obstruct justice, and result in gross injustice to the families of Flint and the families of Michigan." That's some pretty strong language. What's going on here?
It's very strong language. Whether, in fact, it's been compromised isn't clear at this point. But what's going on is that at least these letters indicate that when the civil investigation took place and when employees of the Department of Environmental Quality, for example, were called in and interviewed, those employees were told that if they didn't cooperate, they could lose their job, or at least there was that threat that they could lose their job. What that does under the law, and this is under the U.S. Constitution, the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination, what it does is it gives them immunity. It means that their statements can't be used against them, nor may any information developed out of that statement be used against them. So it can have a major effect on the criminal investigation, because if the criminal investigators get this information, that means they can't take any action, or at least it would be very difficult to take any action against one of those employees. So it could substantially compromise the criminal investigations.
Well, I have to ask, Peter, how common is the legal understanding of how criminal investigations work, this part of the law? Is this at all obscure? Are we talking about, you know, basically criminal law and criminal investigation 101?
Well, it's obscure in the sense that it's not easy to put this into a Law and Order episode or wherever most of the general public gets its knowledge. It's not like a cop reading Miranda warnings. But in fact, it is really quite similar to that, that if you, a government employee, are told, you must tell us what you did, what happened, what you observed, and if you don't, you lose your job, then essentially what you've done is you force them to confess. And just like Miranda, you don't have to talk. It will give you, it being the Constitution, will give you some protection. So this is an important protection, but it is certainly not widely known.
But I guess I've got to wonder, and I'm trying to understand this. To me, this sounds like either incredible incompetence, not realizing that these state civil probes could mar the criminal investigations, or a deliberate attempt to sabotage the criminal investigations. Is that at all a fair way to look at this?
Well, I'm certainly hopeful it's not the latter, that it wasn't the goal to sabotage. What can happen in these things is, and maybe it's incompetence, or even just at the level of the left hand doesn't know what the right hand is doing. The goal in the civil investigation was get information. Well, what's the easiest way to get information? Promise people that what they say can't hurt them. But of course, if you're not thinking about a criminal investigation, and that is very short-sighted, but if you're not thinking about a criminal investigation, you're more than happy to give those employees that protection, that if you tell us something, we won't use it against you. Why? Because your goal there is only to figure out what happened and take any civil approach possible. So I'm at least very hopeful that it wasn't designed to sabotage a criminal investigation, but it could have the effect of at least making the criminal investigation much more difficult if that probe, if the civil probe and the report that was completed apparently in April, if that gets out and if it's widely disseminated in the media, even though the criminal people might not look at it, it can affect witnesses, and that can have the same impact as actually using the statements against the person.
You know, Peter, when we look at these letters from U.S. Prosecutor Barbara McQuaid and Attorney General Schuette and Genesee County Prosecutor Layton, how unusual is this to have this, you know, this blast of letters saying stop now?
Unusual. I mean, it does happen, but typically, and this, what's a little puzzling about this is the state police was involved or were involved mm-hmm. in the investigation and the civil part of it. And with any police investigator, the very first thing that comes to mind when you're talking with a government employee is what are called Garrity rights. That's a Supreme Court case, Garrity versus New Jersey, that says if you force a government employee to testify, they get immunity. Every cop should know about Garrity rights because they have them themselves. Police officers are frequently examined for their conduct, and they understand Garrity. So I'm at least puzzled by how did they whiff on this one? How did they not know it? You as a prosecutor, you as a criminal investigator would expect other criminal investigators to know how this works. So you're right to raise the question, is this just negligence or is it something worse? I certainly hope it's not something worse.
Wayne State University law professor Peter Henning, it is always great talking with you, Peter. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Cindy.
As Detroit wound its way through bankruptcy, journalists from just about everywhere turned out countless pages about the city, about its troubles. But David Marinus took a different approach with his book, Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. He took readers to Detroit in 1963, a time when maybe things could have turned out a whole lot differently, not just in Southeast Michigan, but for the nation. The book is a New York Times bestseller and was on a lot of best of 2015 book lists. David Marinus is headed to Metro Detroit for five Michigan book stops from May 31st to June 5th in Southeast Michigan. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Cynthia.
It is worth reminding everybody as we talk that, yes, you are the associate editor of The Washington Post. You're a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, but you lived in Detroit. You lived on the west side till you were six.
Yeah, I was born in Detroit at Women's Hospital. We lived in several places. The most memorable for me was on Dexter, and I went to Winterhalter Elementary School. So my earliest, strongest memories are of Detroit, of the Boblo boat, of the Werner's Ginger Ale that was such a strong taste that went right up my nostrils.
So true.
Sort of my primordial memories are very fondly of Detroit.
You and I share the very, very same memories. Absolutely. And so you're able to tell this story as a professional journalist, but also that personal angle, which so many folks who tried to record Detroit's story or tell it didn't have that personal angle.
Well, it meant a lot to me. And so really what motivated me to write the book was after seeing that amazing M&M commercial during the Super Bowl in 2011 with all of the iconic images of Detroit, the Joe Louis fist and the Diego Rivera murals and the Fox Theater. And that got me thinking about my connections to Detroit and what I could do to honor it. And so I decided on writing a book that essentially talks about what Detroit gave America, which is a lot, but also during a time when you could see the first signs of its troubles.
And so you've had some 5 years now of thinking, researching, writing, and talking about Detroit. You're traveling around the country talking about the city. What is your take, David, on how the rest of America views Detroit?
Well, you know, I think that when I started the book, America viewed Detroit as a symbol of ruin and of urban troubles and decay. And I think that it's changed fairly substantially since then, particularly in the last year or two. And Detroit is now a symbol of hope. You know, that's not to say there aren't enormous problems still there, but there is a sign of a trend of movement for Detroit. And I think that rather than sort of looking at Detroit as a problem, a lot of people are rooting for it now.
And what about you, David? I mean, as an editor of one of America's leading newspapers and someone with very, very early and deep-held roots in the city, has writing this book changed the way you view Detroit and view Michigan?
Well, I have to acknowledge that I'm a Packers fan, and I always will be. You know, we moved to Wisconsin when I was 7, and I wrote a book about Vince Lombardi. So I'm never going to be a – I mean, I like the Lions, but I'm never going to be adopted as a full-fledged Michigander because of that probably. But certainly this book intensified the sympathetic, strong feelings I always had for the University of Michigan, where my parents went, for Detroit, where I was born, and for the whole state.
David, since Detroit's bankruptcy process, Michigan has certainly been in the national spotlight for a lot of other reasons.
Yeah.
The Flint water crisis, the impending financial collapse of Detroit public schools, despite years of state-appointed emergency managers at the helm. And, you know, when Detroit went under, we heard this, that this can happen elsewhere. Now we're hearing that about Flint and its troubles. What have you thought as if you've watched this unfold since your book came out?
You know, you're right. It can happen anywhere, and it does. And the water problems of Flint are, I think that both Detroit and Flint, in a sense, are canaries in the coal mine, or are slight exaggerations of what's happening in so many different parts of urban America. And what I've really thought most, Cynthia, is my wish that the politics of America today addressed more clearly the needs of urban America.
There should be some great conversations as David Marinus goes to 5 Michigan book stops next week, Tuesday the 31st at the St. Clair County Library, Wednesday, June 1st at the Troy Public Library. On Thursday the 2nd, he'll be at the Grosse Pointe Public Library, Saturday the 4th at the Saline District Library, and then wrapping up Sunday the 5th at the Salem South Lyon District Library. It'll be interesting for you interacting with people from all over Southeast Michigan, talking with them, and it was great talking with you, David Marinus, author of Once in a Great City.
Thank you. Take care.
Still to come, tech startups are cool, but Detroit's other small businesses need help too. We check in on one effort to help the city's small business owners. That's in 10 minutes. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Detroit Metropolitan Airport, you have sure come a long, long way. Used to be, DTW was a dumpy, much maligned airport. But things began to take off after the McNamara Terminal opened in February 2002, followed by the North Terminal in 2008. And based on comments from Delta's new CEO, Detroit Airport's future looks even brighter. Detroit News business columnist Daniel House is with us now via Skype. And you had a sit-down with Delta's new CEO, Ed Bastian. What did he have to say about Detroit Metropolitan Airport?
Nothing but good things. He says it's the best airport in North America, period, was the way he put it. And, you know, if you travel at all, you go into some of these fancy airports around the United States, Denver comes to mind, and they're just so screwy and complicated, and planes, trains, and automobiles to get to and from your flight. Not Metro. And, you know, the other thing that is so amazing to me is that we can get anywhere in the world from Metro. And they're adding more and more international flights. Just today, Delta is inaugurating a nonstop service to Munich, which takes to 6 the number of European destinations that you can get to direct right out of Detroit. It's a very good story, and I think it will continue to be. Delta is expects to hit their all-time high this summer in terms of passengers.
And Delta's planning to have more flights from Detroit to Mexico. So it seems like this is all about auto business as opposed to, especially for Mexico, spring break fun in the sun.
No question about it. They're in the process of negotiating a joint venture with Aeromexico, in which Delta will own 49%. They would expect that they're going to get a lot more access to routes in Mexico, including Mexico City, Monterrey, León, and Guadalajara, to name 4. And a lot of it is being driven by the interest in the auto industry, even as auto companies, both foreign and domestic, are investing a lot in the United States. They're also investing a lot in Mexico. And my understanding is that here in the next little while, Mexico and the United States are expected to complete an open skies agreement, which will facilitate this deal that Delta is in the process of doing. I think that's a real positive sign, but it also shows, I think it highlights their business model, which is skews towards the business traveler. It's not a low-cost carrier. It doesn't bill itself as Southwest. That doesn't mean it doesn't compete with Southwest on certain routes or JetBlue on certain routes, because it does. And any flyer out of Detroit knows that if they price, they can oftentimes price against those lower-cost carriers, and Delta will be competitive. But a Southwest is not going to get you a nonstop service to Munich or to São Paulo, to name a couple destinations that are very popular with the auto people.
Now, the one thing that Delta cannot control but impacts every single person is the TSA experience. And right now, that's not going so well at airports across the country. Did Delta's CEO have anything to say about whether the airlines might be able to do anything to help ease those lines?
Not exactly. I mean, I think their belief is that they're going to get their arms around this. There's been a firing this week of a top-ranking TSA official. I think they're taking this thing very seriously. But this just, I think, highlights the very fragile ecosystem that influences air travel. I mean, it can be weather that can lead to cancellations. It can be staffing problems at the TSA that can cause people to miss their flights. I mean, there's a whole host of or a terrorist event halfway around the world that gets everybody a little antsy. I mean, I was flying to Washington last Thursday, the same day that the Egypt Air flight went down over the Mediterranean, and it happened to be the exact same kind of plane that I was getting on.
Oh.
You know, and does it cause you a moment to think? And then I got to the airport, my flight was delayed by 2 hours. I thought, oh boy, I mean, maybe they're looking at the plane or there's something in the technology of the plane.
Sure.
I don't think it was the case, but you know, there is this fragile ecosystem that they operate in, and Delta's got a fleet of 1,400 aircraft. They're flying, I don't know, 3,000 Delta flights themselves, and if you add their regional affiliates, it's like over 5,000 flights a day. You want to talk about a complicated ecosystem.
Certainly. And, you know, it's interesting as we think about what Ed Bastian had to say about Detroit Metro Airport. And I kind of dug up that 2014 study by University of Michigan Dearborn. It figured that in 2014, DTW generated $10.2 billion in economic impact for Michigan and 86,000 statewide jobs. So certainly seems that future looks just as strong.
Absolutely. I don't think we can you cannot overstate how important Detroit Metropolitan Airport is to this town and this state and this region. And it's a real plus. You know, we're still going to be. And the other thing he said that I thought was pretty emphatic is that Delta will continue to service Tokyo out of Detroit. That is a non-negotiable. Now, there aren't a lot of people necessarily who are not in the auto industry that are going to Tokyo every weekend. But, you know, there's a long legacy there that comes from Northwest Airlines, frankly, mm-hmm. of flying to Asia and using Narita International Airport as a jumping off point to six other destinations in Asia, some in China, Singapore, I believe Manila. So the reach we have out of here is pretty formidable.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Daniel, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty.
Entrepreneurship.
Heart of the community. The next idea.
We are the key to our own recovery.
The ideas of entrepreneurs, of small business, those are the ideas that can be a true economic engine for Detroit and outward into Southeast Michigan. That's the idea behind the New Economy Initiative. It's a philanthropic effort to support entrepreneurs and small business owners. The NEI has become the biggest economic development initiative of its kind in the country. And with us now on The Next Idea is the director of the New Economy Initiative. Pam Lewis, it's good to have you here with us.
It's so nice to be with you, Cynthia.
When we say biggest economic development initiative of its kind in the country, what exactly does that mean, Pam?
What that means is this. So New Economy Initiative was formed back in 2007, and 10 foundations at that time came together and put together a $100 million fund. They recapitalized it in 2013 with an additional $33.5 million. So you're talking about approximately $134 million focused by philanthropy in order to improve economic development within the Southeast Michigan region of Detroit with a focus on the city of Detroit.
And you've stepped into the director's position as of the beginning of this year. And I am interested in your thoughts. What is your vision of what NEI's role should be in Southeast Michigan?
Sure. So, I stepped into the role as director, but I've been a part of NEI for 5 years. And when I think about the role of NEI, I think it's interesting because when NEI first launched, there really was a focus on high-tech and high-growth startups. Where we've evolved to is adding the small business component to that, particularly small business development in distressed communities. And what I'd like to see happen for the future is how those two can actually bridge each other and reinforce each other, and to raise that awareness for people that they you do need both. You can't choose between one or the other.
What does that help look like then? Is exactly how does NEI help someone who has a small business or a good idea?
So, for example, there's a couple of ways we do it. One way is how we invest in these organizations that are supporting these businesses. One key example, you can look at the Build Institute. I don't know if you're familiar with Build, but Build is a very interesting entrepreneurial program that actually is being run out of the Downtown Detroit Partnership. And what they're doing is they're providing entrepreneurial support services to small businesses, not in Midtown and Downtown, but they're delivering that programming out in the neighborhoods. Another example is Prosperous. Out of Southwest Solutions. So they have entrepreneurial programming happening in six different neighborhoods. The point is that people can come into these programs, understand what it means to get that idea out of their head. How do they convert that to a business plan? How do they put together strategies to go after capital to move those businesses along? And what can they do to help get more access to markets?
And when you say the neighborhoods, you led me right to where I wanted to go next, because we've seen so much glamour and attention focused on downtown and Midtown and Corktown. And that's all good.
It's very
because
good.
You want that strong and vibrant.
Absolutely.
But you want to think about, well, where's the love and the attention and the money for the neighborhoods where Detroiters are living?
Exactly. I mean, that's the whole premise around our work. So that's why we focus on what we say from startups to bin-ups or from grassroots to high growth, because we feel like those two worlds have to reinforce each other. You know, technology commercialization, high tech, startups, IT, mobility, all that is awesome. And we need that to accelerate the economy. And we also need that to attract talent. But when that talent is here, when that economy is growing, it can only be sustained if there are service businesses, you know, the coffee shops, the restaurants, the barbershops, where can you get your shoes shine? All these types of businesses matter. And so that's why it's important to invest in both. And we've been moving quite a bit of our grant dollars into those organizations that are supporting existing businesses.
I'm speaking with Pam Lewis, who is the director of the New Economy Initiative, as we continue here on The Next Idea. And one of your really interesting efforts is the NE Ideas Challenge. It's in its third and final year. What is it and what does it mean to someone with a business idea?
So NE Ideas Challenge is a very unique program. It's one of the ones where we launched with our own brand around it, mm-hmm. in partnership with the Detroit Economic Growth Corporation, who's been helping us with the outreach. But what we're doing with the NE Ideas Challenge is a small business challenge focused on existing small businesses within the cities of Detroit, Hamtramck, and Highland Park. And we're actually moving grant dollars directly to businesses. And we're doing that through a very low barrier of entry with an application of no more than 400 words, where they can apply to receive $10,000 or $100,000. Like you said, it's in its third year. Over the last 2 years, we've given $1 million away to 64 different companies. The distinction is that if you are a company that is low revenue to $750,000 a year in revenue, you can apply to the $10,000 award, and we give 30 of those away a year. And then if you are over $750,000 up to $5 million in revenue, you can apply to the $100,000 award. And we give two of those a year.
And that can mean an awful lot. What are some of the big success stories,
oh my
business-wise?
Gosh.
Oh, you look,
yeah.
I look at you
I
smile.
Know. There's been a lot. One in particular, and this also, I love this example because it also shows how NE Ideas is not just about giving the money away to the business, but also all of the 1,200 people that have applied to NE Ideas mm-hmm. are getting connected with the services that we've been supporting through the grantees.
So
and
it's almost like
a very important distinction.
It is. It's like planting a seed in very rich soil.
Exactly.
So it can take root and to grow.
You got it. And so great example, J&G Pallets. They are an existing business that's been around on the east side of Detroit for about 20 years. A group of siblings own it. They were one of our $100,000 winners. And they took that money to develop more a facility that expanded their capacity and their capability and provided more modern equipment for them to develop these pallets that can package and ship things. And so they leveraged that to also receive $100,000 from the Motor City Match Program that the mayor is doing. And they also have now become a part of the D2D procurement program, Detroit-to-Detroit procurement program that NEI funded through DEGC, where they're securing additional business now through their company. So this is just an example. Yeah. It's not about the prize. It's about the connections.
So entering under your tent of New Economy Initiative helps someone who might be new. I might have a great idea for my coffee shop or my whatever business, but I don't know that all of these resources
you
are out
it.
There, but you can help direct.
Exactly. That's the whole role of how do we navigate that. And the beauty about any ideas, because to your point, there has been so much emphasis on startups and so much emphasis on the new economy type fields. Any ideas focuses on the bin-ups. It focuses on those existing businesses that have been around 3 years or more in the communities.
Can what you're doing be replicated elsewhere in Michigan?
Well, you know what? I think so. I think there are definitely strategies that we're doing that can be replicated. When you think of the Any Ideas competition, you think of that challenge and what we're doing there with philanthropy, working to grow and create lower barriers of entry for these small businesses. If you have communities that have high poverty rates like Flint or other communities like that that are outside of Southeast Michigan and outside of the city of Detroit, you could put together a program where you're giving some type of small business challenge to these types of businesses within your community. And the reason why I say the high poverty rate is because that's the charitable purpose clause. That's how we can do that as philanthropy, to give these dollars directly to these companies because they're in these communities that are so distressed. And that's definitely an idea that a lot of cities outside of Detroit are looking at. They're asking us questions about any ideas and what we're doing. There are a lot of questions being asked about what the mayor's doing with Motor City Match. And so these are definitely programs that can be replicated, should be replicated in the communities that are distressed.
Let's bring you back to Detroit as we wrap up here.
Sure.
You know, we see Cleveland as a healthcare center, Brooklyn's a hipster haven, Pittsburgh is a clean tech titan. And there's kind of elements of all of those growing in Detroit. What about Detroit? What do you think Detroit wants to be or is trying to be as it looks to the future?
You know, that's a great question. That's a question that so many of us have kind of debated across the table for so long. Let me talk to you first about the assets that are actually active and activated in Detroit, because it may sound like we're trying to be everything, but I think if you focus on the assets that we have, you can't discount what's happening around food in the city of Detroit, not just from restaurants being developed, but also the distribution and manufacturing of food products through McClure's Pickles, you know, through Bonza. I mean, these are, you know, Ellis Island Tea, that is definitely happening in Detroit. You can't discount the whole notion around mobility and advanced transportation, but that is a Metro Detroit asset. It's really the city of Detroit, but it's not just the city of Detroit. It's the strength of Ann Arbor. It's the strength of what's happening at U of M and the strength of what's happening throughout the region. And then you can't discount the whole fact that you have DMC and Henry Ford Health System, you know, less than 2 miles apart, and their interest in medical device and digital health, and both being actively pursuing technology commercialization and projects that are moving them in that area. And then the last one I can't leave out is the product generators. Detroit has such a wealth of furniture makers, textile, metals, the artisans. All of these things are at play. My take on it is this, because sometimes it's pretty hard to pick. But you can't discount the assets that are there. But if we can be an environment that embraces entrepreneurship, it makes it easy for a person to take those ideas and find this enabling environment to help them grow and create jobs, not just for the region, but also jobs that can employ Detroiters. You know, that can be our sweet spot.
That's well put, Pam Lewis, the director of the New Economy Initiative. And you can learn more about NEI and the Any Ideas Challenge by going to their website, neweconomyinitiative.org. Pam, it was such a pleasure to have you with us on The Next Idea. Thank you so very much.
Oh, it's been my pleasure, and thank you for having me.
Support for The Next Idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.
On tomorrow's Stateside, Flint is struggling with lead in its water, but every city has a lead legacy. Lester Graham talks with an expert on how to avoid growing your garden in soil that's contaminated by lead. We'll learn how that lead got there and what you can do to make things safer. That's tomorrow on Stateside. still to come. Spiced, roasted, crunchy crickets, anybody? Mm-mm. The push to put edible insects on our menus. And then in 10 minutes, what to do about aggressive panhandling. Stay with us. This is Stateside from Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. August 9th, 1974 was a day unlike any in American history before or since. Grand Rapids' home son, Gerald R. Ford, was sworn into office as our nation's 39th president following the resignation of Richard Nixon. He spoke to the nation in what he promised would be the first of many straight talks.
But I assume the presidency under extraordinary circumstances never before experienced by Americans. I am acutely aware that you have not elected me as your president by your ballots. So I ask you to confirm me as your president with your prayers. And I hope that such prayers will also be the first of many.
Tomorrow night at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, National Geographic will present Gerald R. Ford, A Test of Character. It tells the story of President Ford's term in office, that challenging, challenging time in U.S. history. And with us now via Skype is President Ford's son, Steve Ford. Tell us, what is the part of your father's story that this special program really explores in depth?
Well, I think it's the uniqueness of his presidency and how he got there. He was the first man to become president of the United States that did not get elected by the general public. You heard that clip right there. And he was appointed vice president when Vice President Agnew had to resign, and then assumed the presidency when Nixon had to step down. And that'll probably never happen again in the history of this country. And the story that's going to be told on Nat Geo tomorrow night is one of, he probably got to that position, that place in history, because of his own personal character. There were people along the line of his life all the way to Congress and vice president and president that came alongside of him because of his character. And it really gets down to a defining moment when Nixon was looking for a new vice president. He was meeting with the leaders of Congress, both Democrats, Carl Albert, who was the House Speaker, and Mike Mansfield, who was head of the Senate. And Nixon, probably the top of his list at that time, was maybe former governor of New York, Nelson Rockefeller, or probably the former Democratic governor of Texas, John Conley. And Dad was probably on the lower end of that list. But Carl Albert and Mike Mansfield in the Oval Office told President Nixon, the only guy you're going to get through Congress is Gerry Ford, because of his character, his willingness to work across the aisle with to solve problems and compromise. And it was really his character that defined his career.
I'm wondering, what are your strongest memories and emotions, Steve, from that day when you realized, my dad's president of the United States? Can you share a moment with us?
Well, I'll never forget that moment. You know, we all have that image in our head of Nixon waving goodbye from the helicopter steps to his staff, family, friends. And we, you know, just stood feet away. And after the helicopter took off, you remember the moment of Dad having to walk into the East Room of the White House. Mom held the Bible as he took the oath of office. And he was going to inherit a war in Vietnam. He was going to inherit a Cold War with the Russians. Inflation over 10%, unemployment over 8-9%, huge energy crisis, the price of oil 12 months leading up to Nixon's resignation had gone from $3 to $4 a barrel to $12 a barrel. That's 400% increase.
Yeah.
The world and the nation were in a terrible place, and it was going to take some great leadership. And I think that's what defines his presidency, is he was the guy that got us from Watergate, healed the nation, and got the economy moving again.
How did you see him handle the pressures in office?
I think Dad, because of his good Midwestern upbringing, brought a lot of common sense to the presidency. And again, it was that character and that principled leadership that he had learned and been a great congressman for Grand Rapids. I'll tell you, I think it all gets down to a defining quote. When we did the statue of Dad for the rotunda of the Capitol, and he's the last president to be put in the Capitol rotunda, I took about 20 quotes to my mother and said, "Mom, we need to put a quote on Dad's statue." And most of those quotes were by Dad. The one quote she gravitated to the most and wanted on Dad's statue and is there today is a quote by his adversary and best friend, and that was Tip O'Neill, the former Democratic Speaker of the House. And Tip O'Neill wrote basically, "God has been very good to America. During the Civil War, he sent Abraham Lincoln, and during Watergate, he sent Gerald R. Ford, the right man at the right time to heal a nation." And I think that sums up Dad's role, and he would be very proud. Listen, you know, Tip O'Neill and Dad used to fight on the floor of Congress over legislation. They'd find a compromise. And that night, Tip O'Neill would be at our house for dinner, and politics isn't like that anymore.
No, in fact, I think of the tenor of your father's speech, the words we just heard at the beginning of our conversation. And do you ever find yourself wondering what he would think of the tenor and nature of political speeches, the kinds of things we're seeing and hearing in the campaign trail these days?
I think probably that's why one of the reasons this movie is appropriate and the timing, and guys like Peter Secchia and Hank Meyer chipped in to make sure this movie got done, is it's so appropriate. We're going to use this for the DeVos Learning Center. It's a new learning center at the museum and library to teach civics.
And speaking of the museum and the learning center, we're going to see the results of the expansion and the remodeling of the Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids very soon, aren't we?
Yes, that opens in just over, 10 days, somewhere along there. And we did a total redesign of the museum. And now we've added the DeVos Learning Center. Rich DeVos and Doug and their family have been very generous to put up the money so that we can teach young people about leadership, about character, about civics. And those kind of subjects are being cut in the school system. And so we thought it was important to come alongside and do what we could to help young people.
Well, a very good place for everybody to start is watching tomorrow on Nat Geo, National Geographic, Gerald R. Ford, A Test of Character, airing tomorrow night at 9 p.m. And we have been speaking with Steve Ford. It has been a pleasure, Steve. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you.
If you've ever watched the reality TV shows Survivor or Fear Factor, pretty good bet you have seen contestants forcing themselves to eat insects. Now, some of us might be game to explore the world of edible insects. Some of us, not on your life. Julie Lesnick of Wayne State University is on a mission to win over the doubters. She's an assistant professor in Wayne's anthropology department. And thanks to her, this week, Wayne State becomes the first place in the nation to host a conference on edible insects. Julie Lesnick, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So your main interest is the evolution of the human diet. How did that lead you to insects?
So I'm a paleoanthropologist by training, and I found that instead of studying the fossils, like measuring the bumps on the bones and naming different species, I was more interested in what they were doing and in trying to reconstruct their behavior. One of the biggest things that drives behavior is, what do you eat? How do you find your food?
Certainly.
And so I started just trying to think about what they were eating about 2 million years ago. And I looked to our closest living relatives, the chimpanzees, and they eat a lot of termites. They eat ants. They use tools to do it. They're very smart about it. And I started realizing that this made a lot of sense for our ancestors as well.
And somehow drawing the circle up to us today in 2016, why should we consider making insects part of our diets?
Well, it's been a part of the human diet for millions of years. It's still a part of the diet pretty much all across the world, except in the U.S., Canada, countries across Europe. And so it's a nutritious resource that we're just really ignoring here.
And you know, as you say, in many parts of the world, people don't think twice about munching on an insect. Where do you think the aversion came from that we see in Western Europe and here in the U.S. and Canada?
So our aversion is part of just our cultural complexity regarding this food. One, I think there's an environmental basis that up here there just isn't the precedent to have edible insects because of our seasonality. They're just not as predictable. Since they're only available seasonally, we don't have as many species that live up here as you see in the tropics. So I think it was just something that we don't eat. But then Once people started exploring the world, once you get to the age of discovery and the European explorers, Columbus reaching the Caribbean, and coming across these people who are eating insects, and it was such a shock. And the image that the explorers painted of them were like beasts. Como bestias is in letters from Columbus. And it's part of kind of the colonialism, the we're going to civilize you, we're going to call your land our own. And it's just, it's tied up in that as well. And I think that's the ugly side of it that people don't like to talk about.
I think you're absolutely right. But there still is that kind of, for many of us, including the person sitting across from you right now at the table, there's that ew factor about bugs. Where does that come from, do you think?
I think it's just because we don't live in a society where we have a relationship with insects.
Beyond not wanting them around.
Right.
Well, so here we have Eating Insects Detroit, exploring the culture of insects as food, the first conference on edible bugs in this country. So why in Detroit?
I just started at Wayne State 2 years ago, and I did my PhD at the University of Michigan. So I've spent a lot of time in Southeast Michigan. And just in the time that I've been back, watching Detroit just, you know, the entrepreneurial spirit right now is amazing. I live in Midtown, and I'm watching these businesses pop up left and right, and a lot of very sustainable-focused businesses. Mm-hmm. And so when I went to my first edible insects conference, which was in Montreal in 2014, I knew that Detroit was the perfect place to bring it next.
And so what will be happening?
So we have 3 days of conference programming of academic talks and speakers and discussants and some presentations. And that's, you know, Thursday through Saturday. But the fun stuff is in the evenings. So we actually have a 5-course dinner on Thursday night that Detroit Ento is hosting. Tickets may be sold out, but you can go online and see if you can find some. But the free open experience is going to be Friday night, and that's 7 to 9 p.m. on campus. At McGregor Conference Center. And that's our expo. We have about 30 vendors coming from around the world offering samples of their products. And this is, you know, everything from protein shakes and bars to pasta to the different cricket powders you can buy, baked goods, everybody that's doing creative things with insects as food.
We've actually talked to the guys from Detroit Ento here on Stateside. I know they're very involved with making the cricket flour and that. And I guess what could this mean for populations in this country who are battling food insecurity?
And that's a really good question. Something I think about a lot and I think is important for us to remember is, you know, right now the price point is high. Right now, you know, insects are not going to help in that area. But with demand, you know, with the market, with more demand, with more people, you know, accepting it, seeing it, you know, co-op shops and such like that, then price will get driven down. But what's really interesting, where I think there's great potential, is for individual farms. You can have your own cricket farm, your own mealworm farm, like in your kitchen. And then you are in control of your own protein production. So it's kind of like having your home garden, but now you're actually producing the animal protein as well.
Well, I know you brought some samples here. What did you bring for us to try?
So these are Detroit Ento's crickets.
Okay.
What they did is they cooked them up in what we would call to be like chapulines, which is traditional in Mexico. And so it's toasted with a little bit of chili and lime, some salt and garlic.
Well, I am going to call in our production assistant, Daniel, who booked this interview, to give it a try, because I just don't think I can with the insects. And I feel cowardly saying that. And as he comes in, tell me this. What are some of the insects that provide a good source of protein and nutrition? And come on in, Daniel, because you're going to and I guess also just nutritionally, how high caliber is the protein that you're getting from these insects?
So the protein in these are very similar to any of our traditionally raised livestock. I think what's interesting to remember about protein is that it's made that protein is made up of a bunch of amino acids.
Yes.
And a certain number of them are essential to us. And animal foods give you all of those essential amino acids. So it's a one-stop shop. Hmm. And so crickets and insects do that just like beef, pork, and chicken.
All right. Daniel?
Hi. How are you doing?
Are you ready?
I didn't pack lunch today,
I'll
so this worked
these
out
first,
pretty well.
Just to make sure everything's
cold.
Okay.
They are crunchy. Oh, they're crunchy.
Remind me again what's in here.
Yeah, tell her.
So they have a little bit of chili, garlic, salt, lime.
These are good. Reminds me of like, wow, they got a kick to them too.
Yeah, that's the chili. That's the yeah.
They have a kick.
I think I have a leg stuck in my teeth. Can I have more? How much of this can I eat?
Oh my goodness!
This reminds me of almost like hot Cheetos. For example?
Yeah.
Without a doubt, they are totally crickets. How do you win over the non-believers?
What I don't have here for you that I wish I had brought is a baked good made with the cricket powder. Hmm. You know, because then you don't see the legs. You don't get a leg stuck in your teeth. You don't see the eyes. You don't see that they're little insects, you know. And so that's what I think is important in thinking about food culture is that we want to understand it as food. And so if we can present it as something we already recognize as food, then we're more willing to try it. But this, we don't recognize whole crickets as food.
This is true. But the way you responded to the taste, you weren't just being polite. You liked the way they tasted.
Yeah, I loved it. I honestly, I wouldn't mind having a bag of these just in the office.
Well, goodness me. Well, this is just a preview of the kinds of things that you'll be encountering at Eating Insects Detroit, exploring the culture of insects as food, again happening this Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at Wayne State University at the McGregor Center right in the heart of the campus. You can go to eatinginsectsdetroit.org. If this speaks to you and like Daniel, you want to try these spicy crickets, especially the Friday night when it's open to the public, but you do have tickets available for individual or all 3 days.
Yes, for the conference. Absolutely.
Well, she's on a mission. Julie Lesnick, Wayne State University. Great talking with you. Thank you so much for sharing your mission with us. And I guess, Daniel, thank you for being braver than I am and plunging into the crickets.
Thank you for lunch.
Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Earlier this week, the state legislature introduced a bill that would outlaw aggressive panhandling. The legislation would forbid threatening or offensive language and gestures. Now, critics, including the ACLU of Michigan, say there are already laws against this kind of behavior and the bill could violate free speech rights. We wanted to know what people who panhandle thought, so Stateside's Daniel Raisel went out to talk with some folks in Ann Arbor who could be affected by this bill.
Aggressive panhandling, I know a couple people here. There's one person that backs people into the storefront windows, and he also has demanded people to take him to the ATM. So I think it should be a banned.
You know, I could accidentally spill mustard on my clothes and people would think that's aggressive, you know. A lot of people have different little pet peeves or taboos or whatever you call them. For one person to point at a homeless person and say, hey, you can't stand over there anymore. Well, then we don't have freedom of speech.
If you're getting fined for aggressive panhandling, that's usually because you're being the aggressor in the first place. So I see no problem with that particular law in fining people for being aggressive about panhandling.
I think if you sit down and you have a sign and you state in your case, a person can either walk by and look at it, and they want to give, they give, they don't. You're not bothering them, you're just sitting there. It's always a way to get a dollar, you know, without getting in trouble.
Speaking on the streets of Ann Arbor, that was Katie Zedike, Fink Tuttle, James Manning, and Jeff Lee. And that's today's Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thanks for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.